From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now. In the face of widespread criticism of his immigration policies, President Trump met with members of Congress this afternoon and said he would soon end the practice of separating immigrant children from their parents arrested crossing the border illegally.
I'll be signing something in a little while that's going to do that. And the people in this room want to do that. And they're working on various pieces of legislation to get it done.
Let's bring in our political strategist. And joining us today, Republican strategist John Brabender. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. And Democratic strategist Corinne Jean-Pierre as well. Hi, Corinne.
Hey there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And John, did the president cave?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. I think the president truly did want comprehensive immigration reform. And I think we all have to understand there's an emotional side to this issue and there's a factual side. And the emotional side is we're all torn apart when we see a child taken away from their parents. And we're kind, compassionate people. And that feels wrong to us. And we know we don't want that to happen here in America. We also know we have this huge immigration problem of people being encouraged to come here illegally. So I think what the president was hopeful was that there was going to be a congressional resolution that would solve this. I think when Senator Schumer came out and said absolutely not, that he would not let the Democrats in the Senate involve in a sort of a congressional debate, I think there was some transparency that the Democrats wanted to use this as an issue in the fall. And I think the president said, we're going to get this done. We're going to get this done now. If we can't do it with Congress, I'll do it alone.
Corinne, are the Democrats doing a happy dance right now?
I wouldn't call it a happy dance. I think this what we saw was cruel and inhumane. This Trump's policy of separating kids from their families was something that was, you know, not American in 2018. But here's the thing, you know, we have seen this time and time again with this president. He creates a crisis on his own through executive action like health care and DACA. And now this policy, which was horrendous, and, you know, and he demands Congress to fix it. And he was really the only one to fix this crisis. He created it. And so it's not, I wouldn't call it a happy dance. This should not be a partisan issue.
Well, John, do you agree with Corinne?
It was pretty awful.
Do you agree, John, that it's cruel and inhumane what's been going on with these families being separated from their kids?
Well, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't agree that it's problematic. But the problem can get even bigger if there's no ramifications for simply coming and breaking our laws and coming in here illegally. We're just going to encourage even bigger problems. And so it's a typical problem that Congress oftentimes run away from because it does take bipartisanship to get this stuff done. And I think that we find in Washington that doesn't happen very often. So I think it would be a mistake to think that it's only the Democrats or only the Republicans that would look at this and understand the emotional part of this and not see the problem. I think we all do. And I think that's probably why the president acted.
One GOP strategist, Steve Smith, who worked with George W. Bush and John McCain, wrote on Twitter last night that he's leaving the Republican Party over these family separations, writing that the GOP is fully the party of Trump. So did you want to leave your party over this, John?
Well, no, look, Steve has been sort of the leading Republican strategist who has been attacking this administration from day one. I've worked with Steve since 1996, I think, was the first race. And Steve has very strong feelings. And God bless him for living up to what he believes and doing something about it. But frankly, you know, I think that this fall, particularly, the Republicans are going to have an awful lot to run on. By way of example, the economy, the lowest unemployment almost in history, the lowest unemployment with Hispanics and African Americans, where it's a full participation economy. We're seeing that we're making great strides with North Korea. We're also making great strides defeating ISIS, who's almost devastated completely in Syria and Iraq. And so, frankly, I think there's a lot of good things that are happening by this party and by this president. But, you know, Steve can do whatever he wants.
Do you think, though, that some of that stuff that you just mentioned, John, is a reason why we saw the president stick with this family separation policy as long as he did, that he was feeling very confident last week after the meeting with North Korea, et cetera?
Yeah, look, what I've learned with President Trump is that he has very strong beliefs and also a very strong belief in the solutions. And I think that he felt that we were putting out too much of a welcome mat to people just come here and not understand that we do have laws, we do have borders. I think that, as we know, this president is very committed to getting the border wall built. And I think he felt that, you know, we're going to have to get serious about immigration before all that happens.
Right.
I do think when he saw the visuals, I think, you know, he felt compassionate about it. It's my understanding people around him wanted him to do something, and he did.
Corinne, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, what he did with this policy of separating kids from their families was a bridge too far. It was just rock bottom. And we've seen a lot of questionable policies from this from this presidency in the past 18 months. And he just went too far. But I do want to add here that when the DACA situation happened, when he alone again created that chaos and decided that he was going to rescind DACA, he asked Congress to bring forth a bill of love, those were his words, a bipartisan bill. And when that happened, when he received that bill, he blew it up, and he blew it up about three times. And at the end, when Coons and McCain came together, they provided a bill that I didn't agree on because it had $25 billion in it for his border wall, which is what he really wanted. Mm-hmm. He rejected it. So I'm not convinced that he wants to fix this problem. I think Trump is just thinking about himself. He's thinking beyond 2018 and 2020 because that has happened. He asked for it and he was presented with it and he blew it up.
And here's what congressional leaders are saying this morning. House Republican leader Paul Ryan promised a vote on a fix tomorrow.
As I said last week, we do not want children taken away from their parents. We can't enforce our immigration laws without breaking families apart. The administration says it wants Congress to act, and we are.
And here's Georgia Democrat and civil rights icon John Lewis on the House floor earlier on today.
We stand here doing nothing as innocent little babies sit in modern-day camps. That's not right, it's not fair, and it's not just. And Madam Speaker, history will not be kind to us if we continue to pass this unbelievable injustice on to our children.
Just before we move on to another theme, Corinne, is anything going to get done on immigration in Congress?
Well, like I said, I don't know where Trump is. Mm. He goes back and forth. He wants a bill of love. They give him to him, both Republicans and Democrats, not partisan, not one way. Both of them come together and they give it to him, and he doesn't want it.
And John?
Yeah, I would have to disagree with that. To be honest with you, I think we've seen that Schumer and Pelosi really, I don't believe, want to get anything done. They think this is their big issue to run on in the fall. We've seen that with some of their statements. We saw that when they had a great meeting with the president and then did their own little impromptu press conference that did everything but kill immigration reform relative to DACA and other parts of this. And we saw latest with Schumer saying he would not participate in any type of legislation right now in dealing with this issue. So I think that I would say that the Democrats are very suspect on trying to use this and using these children, quite frankly, as a political football rather than somebody who's dedicated to getting this done.
But John, Donald Trump started this. This is his policy.
But
he used this as a leverage. He used the children as leverage. We didn't start this.
Democrats didn't start the immigration problem.
No, he didn't. I agree with you. That started decades ago.
How many people did President Obama send out of the country?
This is not whataboutism. This is about today and what's happening and what we've been seeing and the horrific picture that we've been seeing for actually 3 weeks since the end of May.
Right. We've also seen in the last 3 months.
And this is his crisis. This is his doing. I understand that we have to fix immigration as a whole. I get that. But there's something happening right now, which is the separation of babies, of kids, of four-year-olds, toddlers, two-year-olds, three-year-olds being separated from their family. And this could be stopped.
But we also saw in the last 3 months, according to Homeland Security, we've seen a 300-some% increase of people coming across and having kids that aren't even theirs and saying that they are. So there's multiple problems here. And if we don't get to the bottom of that, it's going to mean thousands and thousands more coming across with that same type of problem. And so what we've got to figure out is a compassionate solution that we all agree on, but we need a comprehensive solution that does make it so that there's laws to come in this, a pathway when you come in here, and also border security.
Okay, forgive the term here, but what What about, in the last minute that we have here, what about health care? President Trump rolled out what are called association health plans as an option for small businesses and self-employed people across state lines to pool together, which could lead to lower premiums, but also may cover fewer benefits than current plans. Corrine, is this another, knife in the back of Obamacare?
It truly is. It's another let's destroy Obama's legacy. But it's not really about Obama. It's about millions of people who have health care. 32 million people have health care because of ACA. And what this is, the skinny plans, they should be really renamed to don't get sick plans. Because under these plans, if you get sick, you're pretty much out of luck. The truth is that Trump and the Republicans sabotage health care in this country and is going to lead to higher premiums for many people.
And we're going to have to leave it right there today. Corrine Jean-Pierre, Democratic strategist, and John Brabender, Republican strategist. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
While much of our focus is on immigration at the southern U.S. border, let's get an update on the migrant crisis in Europe and North Africa. More than 600 migrants arrived at the port of Valencia, Spain, on Sunday after a grueling voyage across the Mediterranean. Boats rescued them off the coast of Libya, but those vessels were turned away by Italy and Malta before they were able to dock in Spain. Annelise Bourgis, the Paris correspondent for Euronews, was on board one of those rescue ships, the Aquarius, and she joins us via Skype from London. Annelise, welcome to Here and Now. You have been reporting on the migrants' journey. How did you manage to get on board?
Well, it was pure luck, to be honest. We organized this trip with Doctors Without Borders months ago. We were scheduled to go out with them and do a rotation, something that they do every 3 months. So it was just luck that we were there when all this happened. Of course, in terms of the storytelling, it wasn't so lucky for the people on board.
What happened?
Less than 24 hours after we left the port of Catania in Sicily, Rome directed us to three different spots. There were at least three different boats in distress at sea. And when they finally got us to one case, there were 219 people aboard two rubber boats, and they were absolutely desperate. Their boats were about to give in. It was a desperate situation. And let me tell you, the fear in people's faces and the screaming, and it was dark. It really was chaos. I have never experienced anything like this. I am sure that SOS Méditerranée, the team of people that are accustomed to rescuing people at sea, it might have not been that surprising for them. They have saved over 30,000 people in the Mediterranean over the last 3 years. But for me, it was absolutely terrifying. I witnessed them doing that job of taking people off the water, people grabbing the fast boat that we were in and desperately trying to come on board, screaming for help. That operation took 5 hours to complete. When all those people were out of the water, then Rome said that they had nearly 500. They had been rescued that same night in different spots in the Mediterranean. So in less than 30 hours, we found ourselves with 630 people on board.
Annelise, there were people on this boat. This is a dangerous journey that they're taking. Did you understand why they were doing it? Did they tell you why they were doing it, why they would take this risk?
It's out of desperation, really. People told me in the hours and days that followed that they didn't really have any other options. The vast majority of them felt as though they were going to be safer in the sea than in Libya. They described horrific treatment. They described abuse. They described violence of all sorts. Women told me about rape. They told me about forced prostitution. Men spoke about rape, about torture in prisons, about being forced to watch other people being raped. And so these people that came from several different countries and got to Libya, they were fleeing either conflict, poverty. They were looking for a better chance in life. They get to Libya and the situation is so dire that it really prompts them, it pushes them out. I spoke to this family, to the father of a baby. His name is Ali. And I asked him, how could you get on that boat? How could you get on that boat with your daughter? And he said, listen, she was safer in that boat than in Libya. And I had to do it. I did it for her.
I want to play a little clip of a conversation you had with Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, project coordinator Aloise Vimard. Have a listen.
We are well prepared and we have food and water enough to keep these people 2 to 3 days.
Well prepared for what?
Well prepared to at least feed and provide basic care for some of the 630 people that came on board that Saturday night and in the early hours of Sunday. And well prepared to wait for Italy to tell Aquarius what we were going to do with all those people. It was the very first time ever since Aquarius started conducting operations, they had always dropped people off in a port of safety in Italy. This was the very first time Doctors Without Borders and SOS Mediterranee had to deal with this kind of scenario. And we spent nearly 48 hours stuck in the same spot at sea between Italy and Malta, waiting to hear from Italy where that port of safety was going to be. We kept hearing all these political messages coming from Rome of politicians angrily talking about migrants having to pack their bags and go back to where they came from. Let me tell you, they didn't board our ship with any bags. They came with nothing. Some of them came on board nearly naked. There was one man, at least, that I saw threatening to jump in the water. He said he would rather die there than go back to Libya.
So now they're in Valencia, they're in Spain. What happens next to these migrants?
They will have 45 days to stay in Spain and request asylum in Spain. Not all the 630 people that were rescued and transferred to Aquarius that weekend are going to be able to stay in Europe. Many of them will have their applications denied. Some of them already know that. Others are really hoping for a chance of a better life in Europe. But the process is going to be long, laborious, complicated. The vast majority of people I spoke to have no idea how things are going to go and kept asking me for advice and for suggestions, which I didn't really have. And I was honest. I told them I don't understand all rules. I cannot guide you through this. They have been assisted by hundreds of volunteers in the port of Valencia with this arrival. And so over the next few weeks and months, they are going to be given a chance to request asylum, to tell their story, to explain why they left their homes. And perhaps they will be given the chance to start a new one, a new life in Europe.
Annelise Bourgies, Paris correspondent for Euronews. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now let's go to the remote border crossing of Tunillo, Texas, where the Trump administration is housing immigrant children who have been separated from their parents. Hundreds of boys are living there in industrial tents as outrage grows about the Trump administration's family separation policy. But as Emily Curitan reports, this isn't the first time this stretch of desert has housed an immigrant detention camp.
Back in November 2016, Robert Hyman drove the 40 miles from El Paso to see a tent in Tornillo.
Really out in the middle of nowhere in the fringe of the desert.
He and about a dozen other immigration advocates were invited. A detention camp was originally opened here under the Obama administration. It was meant to be a solution to overcrowded holding cells after a huge flood of immigrants from Central America, a solution that Hyman and others had been pushing for.
Better access to medical care, better access to showers and toilets, better heating and cooling.
He says the conditions in the tent were a lot less prison-like than other detention centers he'd been in. He was shown the different areas for families, single adults, and unaccompanied children.
The biggest shortcoming is just that there's absolutely no privacy.
Now this Tornillo tent is not for families. It's for minors crowded out of detention centers since the family separation policy began. And this time, advocates like Hyman have not been invited in. And he says the conditions aren't really his primary concern anymore.
there's no cage that you could make that is gilded well enough that it makes up for the fact that you're tearing children away from their parents.
The last census counted 99% of the town of Tornillo as Mexican-American, and a third of the population fluctuates with the seasons as workers in the alfalfa fields and pecan plantations come and go. Down the road from the detention camp, 32-year-old Hilda Prieto is separated from her family by a border. She works in the kitchen of a big house on a pecan plantation.
Tengo dos hermanas allá. We have two sisters over there. Y pues uno ya no puede ir tan
seguido. She says her two sisters are right across the border from here, where they all grew up together. But Prieto doesn't visit anymore.
Pues por la violencia y todo lo que hay allá, ya uno va con miedo.
She says she's afraid to visit because of the violence from drug cartels, which control the Mexican side of the river here. Prieto says her nephew works at the detention camp. And a job like that, a job not on a farm, is hard to come by in Tornillo. Not long ago, the port of entry here was a single-lane crossing, with room for just one car to go at a time. But a few years back, the port was expanded. A huge bridge now crosses the river, but it's still mostly empty. The town was promised factories that haven't been built. And while it waits, there is one new landmark along this river, a huge white tent. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Curitan in Tornillo.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
Starting next Tuesday, General Electric will no longer be part of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow tracks the performance of 30 large public companies in the U.S., and GE was one of its original members back in 1896. But the company has been struggling. GE stock lost almost half its value last year, and it will be replaced on the Dow by Walgreens Boots Alliance. Maggie Lake, hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, joins us now. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
And when we hear of GE, you know, you think of the light bulb, train engines, jet engines. Why is GE being taken off the Dow, and how significant is it?
Yeah, you know, this is really, I think, a sign of the changing economy. And listen, it wasn't unexpected, but it really does underscore the decline of this industrial giant, 110-year run over, right? I mean, this was a company that, as you mentioned, is the engine of U.S. growth at one time, and it's really struggling to remain relevant. Jeremy, you said lost half its value this year, $100 million wiped off its market cap since 2016. So they took a look at it and said, you know what, we just don't think this is a fit anymore. Walgreens Boots Alliance, more in line with one of the dominant sectors of our economy, which is, of course, healthcare.
Right. That makes sense. And just remind us, what are the other companies that are on the Dow at this point?
Well, we've got a few other healthcare, talking about how important that is. You've got United Health Group, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Pfizer, consumer staples are big, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, Coke, and some financials, Goldman Sachs. You know, I think what's more interesting is talk about what's missing, and that's Amazon, right? A lot of people were expecting GE to be taken off, but they really thought Amazon would be placed instead. I mean, that is a huge part of the American economy right now.
Well, it's sort of got its own stock exchange, right? The tech stocks are all in the NASDAQ.
Yeah, well, I know, but you know, there are some that double list. And the point of the Dow 30 is, I mean, is that it is supposed to represent, you know, a swath of the economy. So Amazon may still yet get there, but right now they're going to have to wait.
And when it comes to GE, I mean, it's in the midst of restructuring. There's a new CEO who has taken over. It's selling its railway division. It's trying to sell its light bulb business. What went wrong for GE?
A lot of things over a lot of years. I mean, I think my colleague Matt Egan, who wrote an article about it a little bit ago, put it best when he said it's years of questionable deal making, needless complexity, and murky accounting all together. All of that has sort of left the company facing a crippling cash crunch. A lot of people think it just happened. It didn't. A lot of people are tracing these kind of disastrous mergers over the course of decades, including when Jack Welch was CEO. A lot of people kind of going back and taking another look at that now and saying a lot of this didn't work out the way it should have. They bought high. They're selling them low at a loss, and it's really creating a problem that's coming to roost now.
Well, what direction does the new CEO, John Flannery, want to take the company?
They hope into the future. But first, they really've got to shrink the business, get those costs in line. As you mentioned, they're trying to spin off and sell businesses, and they're hoping to put the focus more on healthcare, again, major part of the economy, power and aviation. They want to be more nimble. And I think, Jeremy, they want to really tap into their innovative past. I mean, almost every company to survive has to be a little bit of a tech company now. And, you know, we mentioned those light bulbs. They invented them, actually reinvented them with LED. GE was behind that. So they do have that innovative past. It's just not what the company's known for now, and they really need to be. But he has a really tall order ahead. He's got to get that investor confidence back. And with the stock falling like it is, that's not easy.
It's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Raul Campos is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica and joins us once again. Hi, Raul.
Hola, Jeremy.
And it looks like we've got some music today that you can dance to.
You know, it's getting to the warmer months and the sunshine's coming out, so summer's just around the corner and it has that vibe.
Make you feel good. All right, well, let's get to
Absolutely.
The music. This is Gorillaz with Humility.
Calling the world from isolation. Cause right now that's the ball where we And if you're coming back to find me, you better have good aim. Shoot it true. I need you in the picture's why I'm calling.
You hear that voice, you know it's a Gorillaz song. Now, this is an animated band created by musician Damon Albarn and artist Jamie Hewlett. So there are all these fictional cartoon band members with fictional storylines.
Right. And I don't know if you recognize the guitar work in there, but that's George Benson featured.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's good to see this kind of like lighthearted music back from Gorillaz.
Well, and what do you like about this song in particular, Humility?
Well, it's fun, you know, and we're talking about summer and just how it's lighter. Following the last album, I think maybe they're making a point to say, you know what, this is kind of like a game check on us, you know, that we got to come back with something that's a little more fun, it's a little livelier. And they're talking about this South African slang that in the album title, which is called the Now. So they're playing with it all.
Okay, well, next let's go to the duo Disclosure with Ultimatum. This is featuring Fatoumata Diawara. If listeners don't recognize that language, this is Fatoumata Diawara singing in the Mali ancestral language of Wasulu. Tell us more about her.
Well, she's an artist that they kind of stumbled upon. They were going through records and digging in a record shop, and they started looking into her discography and found this one sample that they used in the song Ultimatum. And just her vibe led to this song, which, you know, it kind of gives it like this tribal kind of Afrobeat house vibe to the song. And this was after the duo had said they're going to take a little time away from making music. They even sent it out like on a tweet. They wrote out this letter back in the day saying, you know, we're going to take a little time off. And then they floated out the single because they just kind of said it was too good to not put out.
I feel like if you add Afrobeat to something, it's going to be good.
Yeah, right? You can't go wrong with that. It's just, it's a fun sound and it's a fun vibe. It's always about positivity and how to push forward. And you can't miss with this one.
All right. Well, next we have Bob Moses with the song Heaven Only Knows. I feel like if you told me this was from the 80s, I would believe you.
It does have that feel, right?
Yeah.
And these couple guys from Canada, when I first heard about this artist, Bob Moses, I thought it was one guy, but obviously two guys. That one guy's a DJ and he's like into, you know, like the progressive dance music, and the other guy is like more from a punk rock kind of vibe. And they were high school buddies in Vancouver, and years later, they end up meeting inside like a Lowe's parking lot or something like that in Brooklyn, and come to find out that their studios are literally across the street from each other.
Huh.
And you put his punk rock and rock vocals over this guy's production of like electronic beats, and they slow it down, make it a little more mellow, kind of like that 80s vibe that you're talking about. And you get this just beautiful, lush sound.
Okay, well, next we have the record company. This is Life to Fix. Very different vibe here, Raul. This is much more bluesy than the others.
Bluesy rock and right in your face, just kind of like we're going to rock out. And they're L.A. based. I've known them for years and I've been big fans of their music. And the last album got a bit of acclaim. It was Grammy nominated. But, you know, it's been a couple years since their last album, and I think they had to maybe regroup a little bit and get it together again. But they're coming on strong.
And they got a good name, The Record Company. So, you know, they are the record company.
You can't miss with that one. Right. You cannot miss with that one.
All right, we have time for one more song. This is called Trouble on Central. It's by Buddy. Car overheated in the can't afford a rental. Broke down Chevrolet sitting on Central. Turning up my headphones, looking out the window. Lauryn Hill playing, it could be so simple. Damn, I just can't wait till I get home. What the hell is taking so long? I wish I had a girl by my side. Wish I had a brand new ride. I wish I had a light. I wish I had a private flight. I wish upon a star sometime. I wish I had a right. I wish I had the finer things. I wish it wasn't so Cobain. I wish I had you. And I wish I wasn't stuck on Central. I'm trying to think of who we would compare this to, but what do you think?
To me, they give me a little flavor of like Lighter Shade of Brown and maybe, you know, some of the Long Beach hip hop artists that have this kind of a laid back, mm-hmm. you know, vibe to their hip hop. Even a little old school Snoop and Dre,
right,
you know, when you
right,
think about
right.
that. So, you know, this guy's from Compton, so he's from the hood. And this guy's known for playing, you know, really like underground hip hop, that street, you know, and for him to come out with this lighter vibe track, even though he's talking about being like stuck on the street, his car overheated, you know, which again, it's just like chill back. All right, this is going on right now, but you know what? It's going to be better tomorrow. We'll be all right. You know, we can still hop on the train. We can still get wherever we need to go to, but you know, for right now, it's this kind of laid back chill vibe, and it's good. You know, when I first heard this song, it was in a club and it had bad words. So I'm like, oh, I so wish I can play this song on the radio. And then a couple weeks later, they released a radio edit, which is kind of rare these days for hip-hop songs, because they're not that concerned about getting radio play, oddly enough. You know, so not unless you're like with a major label or something like that, but for somebody like Buddy to go, like, you know what, I'm gonna float out a radio edit. I'm all like, aha, perfect. I can be playing this song because I love it.
Good for our business. It's nice to have people
right?
that still
like
want
that.
A radio edit.
We like that.
That's Raul Campos, who is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Raul, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Long Beach, Compton, Watts to South Central. I wish I was in control. Really wish I wasn't stuck on Central.
And you can find all our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Early mornings, I'm on it. Trouble on Central with the homies. Oh no. Pretty soon we gon' take control. Just wait on it.
The United Nations Human Rights Council met in Geneva today with the U.S. seat at the table empty. The Trump administration said yesterday the U.S. is leaving the council. Here's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley making that announcement.
Human rights abusers continue to serve on and be elected to the council. The world's most inhumane regimes continue to escape scrutiny. For too long, the Human Rights Council has been a protector of human rights abusers and a cesspool of political bias.
The BBC's Imogen Folks joins us from Geneva. And Imogen, Nikki Haley described the council as a cesspool of political bias. What's the reaction been like?
I think the feeling here in Geneva is one of weary resignation. People are not surprised that the United States decided at this point to pull out of the Human Rights Council. The U.S. had been warning, Nikki Haley had been warning for over a year that this might happen. I think the language that she used, people find a bit offensive, considering the Trump administration has still not even appointed an ambassador to cover human rights here in Geneva. So there isn't a significant U.S. participation in the work of the council. And what a lot of people feel is there's a lot of sniping coming from across the pond, but nothing very constructive coming.
What does the UN Human Rights Council do? Is it significant that the U.S. isn't there?
I think everybody would like the United States to be here. The United States has, in periods of its history, this is what I'm hearing from diplomats this morning, has been, you know, a champion of liberty over the centuries. And it's disappointing to many that the U.S. has decided to walk away. Now, you know, the United Nations Human Rights Council has the same flaws that the entire United Nations system has, and that is that it is the sum of its parts. It's the sum of 192 member states, and they don't always agree with each other. So nobody, not even the superpower, always gets its own way. But I think certainly what human rights groups here are saying, to suggest, as Nikki Haley did, that this body does no good at all and simply protects human rights abusers, that is seen as something very offensive to say.
Is Nikki Haley's criticism, does it hold any water, though, Imogen? Because this is not the first time that a US administration has stepped away from the UN Human Rights Council. They've done it before. The Bush administration wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah, the Bush administration took a kind of time out from the Human Rights Council. The United States' biggest grouse with the UN Human Rights Council is that Israel is a permanent item on the agenda. Scrutiny of Israel's activities in Gaza and in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, some countries in Europe agree with the United States that this is an overemphasis on Israel, but others don't. Most African nations do not agree. The Middle Eastern countries do not agree. Many of the Latin American countries think Israel also should remain a permanent item on the agenda. And that's the way the votes go. I think of more concern, but you don't actually, we haven't heard the United States talking too much about this. They said, for example, that North Korea has not been addressed. I heard that a U.S. politician supporting this decision saying that this morning on the radio. Now, this is completely wrong. There is a massive, searing, detailed report into North Korea produced by the Human Rights Council that came out in 2014, and North Korea has remained under scrutiny ever since. There's a commission of inquiry on Syria, which has been looking at the conduct of the conflict since it began. It has evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity. This evidence probably will be used eventually in war crimes prosecutions. Its supporters would point to the work it's done on the rights of people with disabilities, on the rights of the LGBT community, on the rights of women around the world, on racial equality, all of these things. Mm. Now, it is the only forum where all of the world gets together to discuss these things.
Right.
And this is why human rights defenders say, stay with it, don't walk away.
Any lobbying to get the US back at that seat at the table, finally, Imogen?
I think Britain is hoping, and many countries are obviously hoping that the United States will come back, but Britain has suggested that the negotiation on reform, and particularly this tricky issue of Israel, of whether Israel should always be on the agenda, the only country that's always on the agenda, whether this can be negotiated away and that this might encourage the United States back. But quite frankly, with this particular administration in Washington, there's a good deal of skepticism about whether this is really about human rights or whether it's about a wider philosophy which is not in favor of multilateralism. We saw the withdrawal from the climate accord. We saw the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Now we have human rights.
Right.
And so there is concern maybe this administration isn't the one to have dialogue with on this.
The BBC's Imogen Foulkes. She is in Geneva. Thank you, Imogen.
Thanks very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.